Its current state, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Welcome back. If you're marking the beginning of the MSU football season by attending Friday night season opener in East Lansing, look for WKAR as we take current state to Adams Field next to the music building between 6 and 7 p.m. this Friday night. My suggestion to broadcast from Eugene next weekend fell on deaf ears, I'm afraid. Later this hour, the story of a remarkable and largely unexpected friendship between women, one an Israeli, one a Palestinian. This is a segment about the bond triggered by a shared experience with breast cancer. It's an extraordinary story. Michigan native Ruth Ebenstein joins us later this hour to tell us about her sister. She considers her her sister. That's with Ibtissam Erekat. All coming up here on Current State for Monday. Michael Brown will be laid to rest today, 16 days after the young African-American was killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. Unrest that was the rule in the days following the shooting has abated in the St. Louis suburb, but a host of critical questions remain unanswered. What were the exact circumstances that led to the shooting? How is the larger St. Louis community responding to the incident? And will a controversial county prosecutor remain on the case? For insights into those issues and to update the situation in Ferguson, Current State welcomes an ex-colleague and friend back to the program. Emmanuel Berry left WKAR for KWMU St. Louis earlier this summer. Emmanuel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Brown's funeral is today. Can you give us the details?
Yes, his funeral's today at 10 this morning. It's at a very large venue in the city of St. Louis. About 4,000 to 5,000 people are expected to attend, including a couple White House officials as well as Al Sharpton. So it should be a big event. The family of Michael Brown has also asked today that there be no protest to honor him and are asking that there be no demonstrations and no protest at all today so that they can lay their son to rest.
Is it expected that people will abide by the Browns' request?
I think everyone's hoping that's what will happen. There have been rumors that Westboro Baptist Church might do something, but that's speculation at this point. People are concerned that people will not respect the family's wishes, but I think everyone in the community is really hoping that, you know, this is a quiet day for the Brown family.
Where does the case stand regarding Officer Darren Wilson right now? There are multiple investigations, I understand.
Yes. So Darren Wilson is being investigated by both St. Louis County as well as the federal government. For St. Louis County, the county prosecutor, Bob McCullough, has a grand jury assembled, and they will decide whether or not to indict him based on if he violated state law. The federal investigation is looking, was put on by Attorney General Eric Holder, and that's asking whether or not Michael Brown's constitutional rights were violated during this shooting incident. McCullough, who is the county prosecutor for St. Louis, is a bit controversial in the sense that people have been asking for him to step down, including from a couple of politicians from Missouri, as well as a bunch of petitions that people have signed. His father was actually killed, was a cop who was killed by a black man, so people feel that he cannot not have a bias in this case. The governor and McCullough, the governor could ask McCullough to recuse himself, but McCullough has said that he would if the governor asked him to, but the governor has said that he will not. So that's kind of where that controversy stands at the moment. As for timeline with the case, it's not, at least the county case, we probably won't see any sort of results until October is what people are saying at this point.
Our guest is Emmanuel Berry, calling in from St. Louis today, KWMU Radio. Emmanuel left WKAR's Current State earlier this summer, and we're talking about the funeral today and other matters related to the killing of Michael Brown. What's been misconstrued regarding some of the facts in this case, Emmanuel?
Yeah, the facts in this case are a little confusing in the sense that the way that the Ferguson Police Department released information initially, it was Friday after the shooting, so almost a week after the incident took place, that the Ferguson Police Department released the name Darren Wilson as the cop who shot Michael Brown. At the same time, they also released a video of a strong armed robbery, which Michael Brown is allegedly a part of. When they released that information, it was misconstrued in the sense that initially they said that Officer Wilson, when he pulled over or initially made contact with Michael Brown, he was walking down his apartment complex street, which is in Canfield Green, and the officer, they say that Darren Wilson asked them to move out of the street, and that's when the confrontation began. What they initially said is that Darren Wilson was unaware of the robbery at the time when he pulled them over, which is true, which is only partially true. He was aware that a robbery had taken place, but when he initially asked Michael Brown to get out of the street, he was not suspecting him as a robbery suspect. It was during the confrontation that he realized, oh, this might be the person who was involved in the robbery. He matches the description. So it's kind of been misconstrued that Darren Wilson was unaware of the robbery at the time when the shooting incident took place, which is not necessarily true. He was not initially pulling over or talking to Michael Brown because of the robbery, but during that incident, things changed. So that's kind of been misconstrued in part because of the way the Ferguson Police Department released information that Friday.
Mm-hmm. There was a great deal of tension and protesting here in the days following the killing. What's the scene been like over this past weekend there in Ferguson?
It has been so quiet. Our newsroom has got to sleep a little bit more this past weekend. There were no arrests made last night, which is the first time in a long time in the Ferguson community. There are still people protesting, still small groups, but very peaceful. It's been different this past weekend, and it might be in part for a lot of reasons. You know, the way the police are handling the protest may be better, and people also, you know, now that October is kind of the day that we've been given, people may be like, all right, I don't know if we can keep this up till October. So it's kind of like a holdover waiting period until results come out.
Have you seen a lot of people from out of town recently?
Yes. Throughout the protest, it's almost been like protest or active riot tourism. I don't know quite how to describe it. But, you know, we've seen people fly in from Detroit, people flying from Chicago, people flying from all over. This weekend, there were a group of communist activists as well as anarchists who are joining these protests. So it's a combination. There are people from Ferguson. There are people from the St. Louis area. But there are also people coming from all over to be a part of what's going on.
There's been a lot of criticism about the media presence there. What's that been like?
It's been insane. I've never been in a media situation where, you know, there's more reporters than people in some cases. I mean, national media, they've all been here, CNN, NBC. Don Lemon's been doing specials. It has been a bit of a media circus. And residents, I can speak from, you know, our perspective here in St. Louis as a local station, people are tired of talking to media at this point. So it's kind of making it harder for us to do our jobs at the moment. But people are really tired of speaking with the media. And it's because it was just such a massive amount here all at once. And it's definitely, I mean, a lot of the national networks are no longer here. So it's definitely slowed down in that sense, but it was pretty hectic for a while.
Former Current State Producer Emmanuel Berry joins us. She now reports for KWMU St. Louis. We're talking about the funeral today of Michael Brown and other issues related to Michael Brown's shooting. Where are community leaders now, Emmanuel, in this process of trying to heal and to learn from what's transpired here over the last couple of weeks? I imagine there are a lot of community conversations happening.
There are a lot of community conversations happening, and they're happening not just in the Ferguson community, but all over St. Louis, because I think this was a wake-up call to the greater St. Louis area. Some of the issues that exist in Ferguson are issues, essentially Ferguson could have happened in a lot of other places around St. Louis County and in the city, so it was really a wake-up call in that sense. But there have been community discussions at universities, the churches have been very active, peace rallies at the parks. I think it's been, it's just the beginning of the healing process. It's barely even started, but it's getting to the point where people can start to have these really important, necessary conversations that people have been sweeping under the rug in the greater St. Louis area for decades on end. So it's going to be a long process. They're going to be difficult conversations, but I also think it's great to see the community want to talk about these things, mm-hmm. because that was not the case a couple weeks ago.
What has it been like for you to cover this story, Emmanuel? You went there to cover race and culture specifically, and then this huge story unfolds.
It's been interesting, and I would say it's definitely been a challenge. It's also been good because I think it's brought more attention in general to the entire newsroom about issues of race and culture. A lot of the things that people are talking about are things that people have covered in Ferguson, are things, you know, that I was researching and looking into and being like, oh, we haven't talked about this and we haven't talked about that. But now I think it's given the entire newsroom a greater sense of some of the racial issues that continue to persist in the greater St. Louis area. And it's also been, yeah, it's definitely been a challenge because these are difficult things to talk about. But I guess I've really enjoyed the experience, and I've enjoyed, you know, the station really coming together to cover this story because, you know, when national media leaves, we're still here.
Sure.
This is our home. This is our community. This is where we live. So it's been a great experience, I think, for the station as a whole to really come together and show what we're capable of, and it's been great to be a part of that experience.
Well, I'm sorry it's these circumstances that brought us back together, but we are very grateful for your time. Emmanuel Berry, formerly of WKAR's Current State, joining us live this morning from KWMU St. Louis. Thank you, Emmanuel.
Thanks, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. What is sisterhood? Our next guest's experience suggests the path to acquiring a loving sister can be unexpected and extraordinary, and here to tell us more is Current State's Melissa Benmark. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. Ruth Ebenstein belongs to a diverse group of breast cancer survivors whose mission is to support other women with the disease who are in conflict zones. In 2010, Ruth, who's a Michigan-born journalist, emigrated to Israel. Actually, that was before 2010. But in 2010, she befriended a Palestinian woman who was also living with breast cancer. And pretty soon, Ruth and Ibtissam Erekat, two women from dramatically different backgrounds whose larger communities were regularly in conflict, really became best friends, really sisters. Ruth Ebenstein has told the story of her unexpected bond in Atlantic Magazine, and over the last weekend, she spoke in several places in mid-Michigan about her experiences. And the first thing I wanted to find out, of course, was what happened with the diagnosis in 2010.
I have to say this was kind of the amazing thing that came out of cancer for me. I was diagnosed at the age of 42 while nursing my baby.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was really scared. I had three small children under five, and I was kind of, you know, I'm a little person, and I'm healthy and really active, and just assumed longevity was my birthright because my grandparents were Holocaust survivors who lived a long time, and blessedly my parents were fine. So it was an absolute shock to be diagnosed with cancer. And while I was still healing from my lumpectomy surgery, I got an email from a friend that said, would you like to join an Israeli-Palestinian breast cancer support group? And I had this flash, like something good, really good, might come out of something really bad. And it did. Now, it's kind of amazing. We are both religiously observant women. I'm Jewish, you know, she's Muslim, but we're both traditional in our observance. And I married late in life, as did she. We both married in our early 30s, which is late in our respective communities. We both married older men who were divorced with children. We were both diagnosed with breast cancer while nursing, which is uncommon. You know, it's hard to find a lump while you're nursing, and if you do, you think it's milk. So that was also a similarity. And we each had three children in 3 years.
That's really spooky, almost, the parallels.
Yes, yes. And those are, you know, those are the sort of the quote-unquote the facts on the ground. We both have big personalities. We both laugh heartily and a lot. And we both don't really care what other people think. We're both just out there, you know. I wish you were on the phone with us, too. She's just got a big personality, and, you know, she says what she thinks. And it's especially uncommon how open she is about her breast cancer experience, because that's rather uncommon in the Palestinian experience, in Palestinian society.
Mm-hmm.
Many of my other friends in the group do not disclose their breast cancer diagnosis or history, even years later, even to their sisters and cousins in the family, because it makes you a persona non grata. And some fear that people won't want to marry into their family, or others won't want to socialize with them. It's quite sad. So Ibtissam kind of telling the whole world, allowing me to share our friendship and our history. We were interviewed by the BBC and Al Hura TV, which is a U.S. government-funded satellite Arabic station. So in English and in Arabic, we've kind of told our story to the world. We both do so gladly, and we both are committed to helping other women who find themselves with the same diagnosis and the same illness, supporting them individually and encouraging them to take advantage of the best medical care they can and to reach out for support groups, just as we have.
So she's not only, you know, featured in your article, but she's actually come out on her own in other venues to talk about your friendship and talk about surviving the cancer.
Absolutely. I mean, I have more access to media because I am a trained journalist myself in print journalism. I'm a writer. And being an American, it's easier for me to reach out, just as we're doing now in this interview. But she's right there with me. And the Al Hura TV was in interview was in Arabic. So we first did an interview in her home. And then we did 7 minutes live in the studio. So I had, you know, the little thing in my ear translating. But that was really her show. And I was delighted. And it also felt incredibly appropriate. You know, the story should be told in English and in Arabic. It was also fascinating listening to her tell her story in Arabic, because it touched her heart in a different way. As we all do when we speak in translation, there's a level of distance. When she told her story in Arabic, she really cried. And when she watched it, she called me and said, you know, I'm crying. It's so amazing. I think it kind of amplified our togetherness in Arabic for her, you know, to get that story out there.
Because there's probably a degree of emotional accuracy in your first language that is not going to be there necessarily in a second language.
I agree. And I was even happy to be the odd man out who didn't understand everything that was going on. I felt that was more parody. Ibtissam has wonderful, wonderful English, which she taught herself just off the television.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Wow.
It's unbelievable what she knows how to say in English. I'm thinking, from TV? Wow. You know, my Arabic's pitiful. I know a few words here and there. We're always joking around, but, you know, I really have got to take Arabic. My children will start studying Arabic, and my oldest is starting third grade, and he'll be studying Arabic in school, so he'll do the translation for me.
I was going to say, it sounds like your kids are already starting, and they've spent time with Ibtissam's kids. How do they get along? And do you think they will remain friends as they get older and things get inevitably more complicated?
They get along beautifully. And it's fascinating that they get along so well, because they're not the same age. My children are almost 5, 6.5, and 8. And hers are, I think they're 14, 15, and 17. I mean, teenagers.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, exactly. It's like, you know,
so,
they're not.
There's a gulf there, yeah.
They're not natural playmates, quote unquote. However, they get along so well. The second we arrive at their house in Abu Dis and I park the car, my kids kind of tumble out of the automobile and run right to one of their children. You know, she's two boys and a girl, and they run and grab their hands and go you know, go buy treats and play soccer and hang out, and they just get along so well. It's interesting because they don't really have a common language. I mean, her kids really speak Arabic. They have some English, and my kids obviously speak English. So they connect, but I think it's amazing to see how when you want to connect, you can. And it's interesting that I think these children, on some subterranean level, understand that their mothers went through the same thing. There's some deep bond there. My children have never said that to me, but I think they get it. I'm sure her children get it. And they also understand how intimate we feel with each other, Ibtissam and I. Ibtissam always says, you're my best friend. So they know that. And my children feel, I think, almost instinctively close to my sister's children for that same reason. They get along really well, but I think they know, wow, our moms are really close. So they start at a certain level of intimacy. Now, my middle son, he in particular bonded with Ibtissam. Then when I had the Al-Hura TV interview, I knew that there was room in the car to take two children. So I thought I should take the two older ones. And my middle son said to me, I feel ashamed that I don't speak Arabic. So I feel uncomfortable going. And I said, you know, I respect your choices. Whatever you want to do, if you want to come, you don't want to come. So he decided not to join us, and I took my youngest son, who was 4.5 at the time, and when we got home, they had a blast. He asked how they connected. You know, my middle son asked his two brothers, so how did you speak to them? So my older son said, yeah, well, we were playing soccer. When they said goal, I understood. You know, I was like looking at his brother, like, what are you talking about? We play the international game of soccer. We know how to talk to each other.
Right.
My youngest sat on the swing, and with Ibtissam's nephews and little cousins, and he developed some intricate little spitting game, but going, you know, like, it was hilarious. It was so cute. And they were giggling and cracking up and even swinging together. And you realize people really can connect, even without language, when there is a will, when there is a desire, when you have the right conditions and that warmth, it just happens. And when I look at our children playing together, I see the peace. I just see it. Now, you're asking me about the future. I think that, like all relationships, relationships just build over time. When you have more and more experiences of togetherness and more memories, and as they get older, as they learn Arabic, as they're able to speak with them, I even think all of us have kind of improved our language skills. I'm in touch with Ibtissam's children on Facebook and her stepson. As I said, Ibtissam married Ahmed, and Ahmed brought four children into the marriage, three girls and a boy. And Ibtissam's stepson, Muhammad, just got married. And I called her. I knew when she'd be leaving for the wedding hall. I was invited. I mean, if you check my Facebook page, it's funny because the invitation's there in Arabic. And they're, you know, 66 names, I think, in Arabic. And then, you know, Ruth Ebenstein, Jewish girl from Southfield, Michigan. It's quite hilarious. And Ibtissam even asked her nephew, who's hearing impaired and studied in an Israeli, Jewish Israeli school and can write Hebrew, to translate the invitation. So he's translated the invitation for me, the text in Hebrew. And every single one of her kids wrote to me or shared pictures of them dressed in their suits, you know, or I in a beautiful dress. Like, each child included me in the picture so that I could see.
Wow.
Yusuf, her youngest, it says, you know, Yusuf Arakat with Ruth Ebenstein. It was hilarious because he wanted to make sure that I saw how wonderful he looked in his suit. And it was so touching. And so my mom and I called. I mean, I called and put my mom on the phone too. We called Ibtissam to say congratulations. And I knew she was just getting in the car and going. And she said, you're my best friend, and I'm so touched that you remembered and that you're calling now. And it was as if, you know, she was taking me with her to Muhammad's wedding. And I waited. The second I got up in the morning, we have the 7-hour time difference. We're 7 hours behind them. Then I right away checked to see the pictures of Muhammad. You know, what suit did he wear and how did she look and what did everyone have to say about it? So we have that connection, the children and I, separate even from Ibtissam. Now, As most of our listeners know, you know, times are really tough right now between the Gaza Strip and Israel. I mean, there's
yeah.
you know, a battle going on there. And, you know, whether you call it an operation, a war, whatever you call it, it's really, really horrible right now, what's going on. And the kids reach out to me during those times as well, when there are terrible things and terrible news. They kind of share it with me, and they're looking to me to navigate, to explain, knowing that I'm not racist and I don't subscribe to a lot of these horrible things that have been said, you know, on both sides. But that's what a friendship is.
Right.
I wouldn't want them to not share that with me. And it's real, you know, the Israeli-Palestine conflict is a real conflict. It's a bloody conflict. It's a seemingly intractable conflict. And so I just want to explain to listeners that it's not that we gloss over everything. We don't. We share the pain of what's happening on both sides with each other. But our friendship isn't just about politics. Most of my friendships aren't about politics.
Right.
A friendship is about friendship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go to a party and you start talking to someone and you recognize that someone. That someone's like, wow, you feel familiar to me. I like talking to you. I would tell you my secrets. You make me laugh. I feel at home with you. That's what Ibtah Sam and I have. You know, she didn't grow up in Southfield, and I didn't grow up in Abu Dis. But we just connect. We just get each other.
I guess one thing I have to wonder about, though, is that with the shared experience of having breast cancer between the two of you, do you, or to your knowledge, does she ever get angry that you feel like, you know, the real fight is for life, to stay alive, and yet there's this intractable conflict that is also going on it must be frustrating at times to feel like, no, you know, the focus on people living good lives is where we want to be.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I know that for me, I'm a changed person after cancer. I'm a changed person because I see conflict differently now. You know, man-made conflict seems almost ridiculous.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, breast cancer is the kind of cancer that can always come back. There can always be a recurrence. It never goes down to zero. Someone in my support group is having a recurrence 28 years later. So you know that it's out there. You know, God willing, you're never going to see that thing again. But it's out there. And it does seem ludicrous that we're fighting over, I don't know if it's land recognition, you know, territory. You know, it seems crazy. An interesting thing that Ibtah Sam and I did together is that our support group was invited, an Israeli-Palestinian delegation, an 8-woman delegation, 4 Jewish Israelis, and 4 Palestinian women were invited to Bosnia and Herzegovina to meet with Bosnian, Croatian, and Serbian women who joined together also across religious and ethnic lines to support each other. So we were invited to, the idea was that something will happen. These women who are from conflict regions, who support each other across the conflict, have what to share with each other and can learn from each other. And I was delighted to go. You know, there was a lottery, and Ibtah Sam and I were both chosen, and we were both very excited to go. And I thought, well, first of all, I was happy just to go anywhere. I hadn't gone anywhere since I'd had cancer, and I thought, I'm going to leave my kids at home. This is an all-expense-paid trip. My husband can't complain. And it was even around my birthday, so it was hilarious. But going there, you know, you look at their conflict and our conflict, the whole thing seems crazy. And you realize what a fight for life is and how precious life is. So I don't have a lot of power to change things in some grand way. I'm not a politician. I can change things on the level of one person being active, and here is where the health activism comes into play. I was invited to attend a Knesset meeting. The Knesset is the Israeli parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And I was invited to attend a committee to promote the advancement for the status of women and gender equality. That committee had a gathering about breast cancer, which I attended. And while I was sitting and listening, I thought to myself, you know, breast cancer is a known phenomenon now. You know, in October, you'd have to be really like dig a hole in the sand and stick your head in there to not see pink somewhere, right? It's just everywhere. People talk about breast cancers and mammograms and mastectomies and ultrasound. You know, Angelina Jolie, celebrities have come out with it. It's a very common thing now. A lot of women know someone who's had it and are familiar with it. And even if you've been blessed and it hasn't touched your family or friendship circle, you've heard of this. But in Israel, heart disease is unknown. There hasn't been a Go Red campaign. And while I was sitting in that Knesset meeting, I thought to myself, gosh, they're talking about breast cancer, but for every one woman in Israel who dies of breast cancer, 10 die of heart disease.
Really?
And And it's so 28% die of all the cancers combined, and 28% die of heart disease. And I approached Aliza Levy, who's a Knesset member, and said, hey, why don't we get together and promote heart disease awareness, you know, women's heart health in the Knesset. Let's take this ball and run with it. And voila, I became a health activist. I joined with a center at Hadassah University Hospital, actually pioneered by Dr. Donna Zwas, who also grew up in Southfield.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
And we've just been helping, in particular, disadvantaged women. So that includes Palestinian women, ultra-Orthodox women, and women with special needs / disabilities to take responsibility for their own cardiovascular wellness, changing things, really starting with first graders and second graders in Palestinian schools to change eating habits and awareness. And it's been incredibly gratifying. And that's something that is a direct outgrowth also of my breast cancer experience. My husband was teasing me because he sort of said, you know, what's with you and heart disease? Like, you know, how does this even relate to your life? And I said, I just feel that it's important to try to save lives now. Now that I understand how precious it is, I want to do something. You know, I want to make a difference. And here I found a realm where I could.
You can't unlearn the perspective.
No, you can't. Someone asked me at synagogue a few weeks ago, someone who was diagnosed with colon cancer and had just completed her chemotherapy regimen. And she said, am I ever going to go back to what I was before? And I said, no. I said, at least if you're like me, the answer is no. That doesn't mean it's only going to be worse. It's going to be different. You know, I cannot worry about a scratch in my car the same way ever again. I mean, it seems crazy. You know, it's your car. Who cares?
Right. Right.
And you appreciate everything. You really do. Now, I'm not saying anything deep or new. Anyone who's listening who's fought an illness or had any kind of experience like this knows exactly what I'm talking about. And those of you who don't, I hope you stay on the other end of it. But it does change things for you. And you want to share whatever you can of that understanding to change the world a bit. And I think that Ibtissam feels the same way. So, you know, I often say, if you put us in a room, Israeli and Palestinian breast cancer survivors, and if we take off our shirts, can you tell who's Israeli and who's Palestinian? We're just breast cancer survivors. We're women who've been attacked by the same illness. So that is so powerful. It's so profound.
It is.
And I wish I could impart that message to everyone, to just see each other's humanity and similarity and life force. And in Ibtissam, I found an amazing friend. And we're not friends for the media. You know, she's my friend. Now that we have this friendship and we can share our experience with others, we are both committed to doing so. But we love each other just 'cause.
Right.
And I imagine that if Israelis can meet Palestinians, every single Israeli would find a Palestinian who could be his or her best friend. Because we're just people. You know, we're just people. We really are. And I would not have been able to meet Ibtissam without breast cancer. She lives on the other side of a separation barrier. She needs a permit to get into town. So we needed that way to connect with each other, a regular place to meet, an automatic thing that created intimacy between the two of us. And, you know, here we are. We always joke around, like, I got one sister from my parents, and then I got another one for breast cancer. And she says, you know, I got six brothers from my parents, and then I got you, you know, as my sister.
That is very, very cool. How do you respond to people, Palestinian and Israeli, whose opinions don't reflect yours and Ibtissam's, who say that you're doing something wrong somehow?
That's an excellent question. It's, first of all, there are people who are very inspired by this friendship. And when I post things on Facebook or they read about it, they laud and applaud and support us. There are others who look at us like we're crazy or deluded, naive. These last two months, I would say, you know, where it's been really tough with Operation Protective Edge, you know, with the terrible things that have been happening in Israel and Palestine in June and July, I was sad to see that some friends who were more open in the past have kind of shut down. Now, some of these friends have their sons fighting in the Gaza Strip. They're soldiers. And so I can't judge them because I can't imagine what they're going through. But I was saddened by it. And I accept that not everyone is going to see it the way that I do. And I am hopeful that people will open up. I remember I have a friend, actually my husband's friend, a wonderful woman, who is not open-minded in this political realm. And after she read my piece in The Atlantic, I said, you just, you know, read that article, and you saw the BBC clip on my friendship with Ibtissam. I said, do you think that we need a separation barrier for her? And she said, no, you're right. Now, I'm not going to get into the whole politics of, you know, they erected the separation barrier after a spate, you know, horrible terrorist attacks, the buses blowing up, etc. So I'm not going into the political place of it. But I want to remind us of just the humanity of each other, that we're people. And when it becomes the Palestinians and the Israelis as blocks, that's the depersonalization and the dehumanizing. Now, sadly, part of that is necessary during wartime. We have to dehumanize the other so that we can go into battle. And what can I say to my friends who are fearing for their sons' lives? You know, I don't have words for that. Now, I could try to explain the differences. I could say, Ibtissam has been intending an Israeli-Palestinian support group on and off for the past 15 years, and only off because when the group took breaks, she's a person reaching across the divide.
Mm-hmm.
She is someone who is embracing me. You know, her Facebook page, I'm all over it. She's not hiding her friendship with me. And she lives in the West Bank. So the West Bank is not the same as the Gaza Strip. And there are Arab citizens of Israel who are not the same as the, you know, who are sometimes called Palestinian Israelis. They are different from those who live in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. There's a lot of nuance here. But I think that sometimes we're inclined to kind of blend everything together. It's hard for us to see nuance. So I hang on to my hope that we will get back to a more peaceful time soon, and people will open up to that nuance. And we're just going to keep on being friends and hoping for the best.
I don't know if this is something that you feel comfortable talking about, but if so, can I ask how is your health?
Oh, sure. No, I'm really open, and I even would like to just even remind listeners to take care of their own health. But I'll start with me. Thank God I'm well. I was really blessed. My oncologist fought like a lion, and I didn't even need chemo when I had breast cancer. I just had surgery and radiation, which is really, really fortunate. And I'm almost 4 years out, so the further you get from it, you know, the better it is. I had a prophylactic oophorectomy. I don't carry the gene. So thank God I'm okay. I would like to say to listeners that I went on an instinct in my head that something was wrong with me to a breast surgeon. I want to remind all the women, and men too. I mean, even though men are 1% of breast cancer incidents, it's not zero.
My great uncle had it, actually. Yeah.
Wow.
Did
okay,
not know,
so you know
that
exactly
until him, yes.
Pardon me?
I did not know that men even got it until he got it.
Yeah. So just men and women, don't be scared. Take care of yourselves. Whether you're doing mammogram or you're supposed to be getting MRIs, if you're not doing either one of those, or even in addition to that, find a breast surgeon. Do not go to your gynecologist. Your gynecologist is better than zero, but breast surgeons are trained to find these. Now, in my case, I went to a breast surgeon, and he found a lump while I was nursing, so I was lucky that he found that, and my oncologist said that to me, you're so lucky that he caught it, because most doctors would have just sent you home. So I saved my life following my instinct and just going to the doctor on an instinct, not feeling a lump, but feeling weird. Now, when you have cancer, you don't, at least in my case, I didn't feel sick. I felt off. So this is extremely common. It's a very common cancer, and they can do a lot for you, especially when you catch it early. That's why, mammograms and colonoscopies, they're in the system. Those are slow-growing cancers where they check regularly because they can help you. They can save you. You know, breast cancer clubs are everywhere because there's so many breast cancer survivors.
Sure.
So that's my plan for myself, is to be a survivor for a very long time, and God willing, not to see this thing again, except in my health activism and, raising awareness. And, inshallah, God willing, we should all be healthy and well. But you really don't be afraid. If anybody wants, they can take a look at my website, laughthroughbreastcancer.com, just to see. You'll see I don't look like a survivor. Like, if you see me walking down the street, I just look normal. I just look like a person. So you don't have to be scared of finding out what's going on in your body. You're going to be okay. You really just want to take responsibility for your health. Your body is your most precious resource. And I never thought this is what would come out of it. Never in a million years that I would end up developing this kind of friendship with Ibtisam, that I would be sharing this story around the world. It's just not what I expected or planned for myself. But here it is. And this friendship's a huge blessing. And it's a different life, but it's not only bad. I really don't sweat the small stuff the same way. I feel really lucky. I just wish that for all of us, that we can take from these experiences that we have the best and learn what we can and apply it to our lives. We are all going to find ourselves facing a challenge we did not expect. And what are we going to do with it? You know, who are we going to be with that experience? And that is in our hands. I'm not special in this way. I'm not. You know, it approached me and I took it. And each one of you who is listening to me can do the exact same thing. And it really will fill your heart so much.
Ruth Evanstein, best of luck to you and to Ibtisam, and for your friendship and for your health as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Current State, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Thanks for joining us. Current State often presents stories of Michigan history. This is one of the oldest. Before the existence of life on our planet, geologic forces were working to form the stuff of our world, the very earth beneath our feet. It's the passion of Lake Gitche-Gumee Museum of Agate and History director Karen Briz. Karen has collected rocks and minerals almost her entire life and has run the museum in Moose Lake, Minnesota for nearly two decades. WKAR's Peter Wharf spoke with Briz last week about her geologic pursuits and one of Michigan's most characteristic natural materials.
Agate is a pocket inside host rock Most of the time, the host rock is igneous, but it can be sedimentary and very rarely metamorphic rock. And that pocket fills from the outside in with a very specific type of quartz called chalcedony. So to be agate, you have to be more than 50% chalcedony, and there has to be self-organized structure.
What is chalcedony?
A chalcedony is a form of microcrystalline quartz.
Okay. And what does it look like?
Well, in its a pure form, it's gray. But to see the individual crystals, you need a scanning electron microscope.
What makes it desirable to people to have this?
Well, you know, as far as the Lake Superior agates, they're rare. They were formed 1.2 billion years ago, so they've been spread by geologic forces. And we've had, you know, probably 20,000 feet of sedimentation, glaciation, and everything since the agates first became free from their igneous matrix rock captor. And it's just the hunt. And occasionally you find some nice agates. I've seen a couple this summer that could be valued in the hundreds of dollars.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you know when you've found a good one? What does it look like?
Very obvious. You're going to see a waxy luster. You're going to see some of the self-organized structure. And a good agate will have either high-quality banding or contrasting in colors and not have a lot of surface fractures or other abrasions on the surface. And size. The larger the agate, the better.
Sure. You described sort of a natural state of gray color. What are some of the other colors that are desirable and found?
Okay, well, many of the Lake Superior agates, you know, over the millennia have been dragged by glaciers and other geologic forces through iron-rich soil. So there's an awful lot of post-formation staining of red, the iron oxide red color. And so that's another thing to look for. And in some cases, that iron oxide actually oxidizes more into a kind of mustard color limonite. So those would be two other colors you would look for. In addition, many of the Lake Superior agates have a pit mark surface. When the pockets first start filling in, sometimes another mineral crystallized first and very often into these round spheroid type shapes. And those have since worn away, leaving behind the molded impressions of what used to be. And it results in a pit mark surface.
Karen, where might you find these agates in the Lake Superior area? What types of settings?
On the south shore of Lake Superior, you find them on the beach, and the reason why you can find them there is because the waves wash the rock, and so you have clean rock. I mean, if you were to be, let's say, digging a foundation, and there's rocks in the dirt, you know, going down, frankly, thousands of feet, you know, there would probably be agates there too, but they're not accessible. In other areas of the upper Midwest, you can also find them in farm fields. You can find them in gravel pits, although most gravel pit owners do not let people in anymore. You can also find them in rivers, you know, in gravel bars on rivers.
This is Peter Wharf for Current State on WKAR. I'm speaking with Karen Briz, the owner and curator of the Gitche-Gumee Museum in Grand Marais, Michigan. How long has your museum been around, Karen?
Well, Axel Nemi started the museum in 1954, and he ran it till about 1980, give or take a year or two. And then it was closed until I reopened it July 4th, 1999.
Yeah, what brought you an interest in curating this museum?
Well, Axel was a major influence on my life. I was actually blind till I was 10, and my mom used to drop me off there after I developed a little bit of eyesight, and Axel would put rocks under my face. I only had a vision of a few inches, and he would tell me the stories of the rocks. And then one day, he had me meet him at night, at 11:30 at night, and he showed me the rings of Saturn through his telescope. And when I saw the rings of Saturn, he said to me, "Karen, given your eyesight problems, if you can see the rings of Saturn, you can do anything." And that was the first day of my life I believed that to be true.
Wow.
So it's a real privilege to carry on his legacy now.
So ever since childhood, you and he have, you began to share this interest in science and creation.
Yep, and in agates and rocks. And, you know, that went on, and I had a corporate career and traveled a million and a half miles around the country. And wherever I went to rock shops, and I would buy at least one, you know, high-quality specimen for my collection. And then I got a chance to buy the museum and reopen it, so I did.
What other things would we see at your museum?
Well, the Nemi family came here from Finland in about 1905, and as people came and went from Grand Marais, they collected artifacts. So I have a lot of historical artifacts of the town, too, the logging era, the fishing era, and just other Grand Marais memorabilia. And I do have a rock collection in addition to an agate collection, and two rooms of gift shop.
Karen, describe some of the highlights, some of the real prized items that you have there.
Well, I'd like to talk about a couple of them. First of all, I have Axel's 5.5-pounder Lake Superior agate that he found in 1958. And then one of my other favorite agates, it's actually a Brazilian agate, but it was naturally polished by the African diamond dust deposited in the Brazilian river during the time of the supercontinent Pangaea. So it has a very high polish to it, all done by the diamond dust in the river. So it's proof of plate tectonics.
Wow, that's amazing. So this goes back to before the continents as we know them. This is something that's that old when you had the supercontinent Pangaea.
Oh, certainly, yes.
Wow, what do you feel like when you find or hold or talk about things like these?
Well, it's a real joy to, you know, share these with the public that come in the museum, because so many people, you know, come from their busy lives, and they come up to the shore of Lake Superior then to recharge their batteries, and in many cases, frankly, people aren't aware of agates. So when I show them some of these prized agates, you know, their eyes get as big as saucers, and they get excited, and then, frankly, they get the rock hounding bug, which is really my passion. I love teaching people how to find them, and, you know, I've written books and produced DVDs and online classes, and, you know, if I can help people recharge their batteries and go on the beach, get some exercises, you know, get out in the fresh air and maybe find a few treasures, you know, I think it adds to their quality of life.
Karen Briz, the owner and curator of Gitche Gumee Museum in Grand Marais, Michigan. Karen, thanks for the conversation today.
All right, thank you very much.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll review the top news stories of the month from the Great Lakes Basin with environmental reporter Gary Wilson. That and more tomorrow on Current State. We're glad you could join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.